pleasure, after many years of knowing Dan Brown in King's, to have a chance to talk to him about his life and work. Dan, can you start by saying when and where you were born?
So, Alan, I started in Glasgow, at least in the smaller town just outside Glasgow, but Glasgow was...
What was the small town called?
It was called Giffnock.
Giffnock?
Giffnock, yes. Yeah. Strange name. People in the west end of Glasgow used to, when you said where you came from, they sniggered a little. it was on the south side of Glasgow, the developing side. That's an unnecessary comment because
it's a human comment. It's a human comment, and we want lots of those.
He was on the road to Kilmarnock, and that was great. My father.
When were you born?
I was born in 1923.
1923, yeah.
And I will be 85 in a month's time.
Oh, congratulations.
I've reached that point.
Your father was?
My father was a restaurateur in Glasgow. Not of his own wish, but his brother, having been killed in the First World War, his elder brother, my father, perforce took on his father's business. And his father's business had been around, I think in 1947, it had been in Glasgow, not exactly in the same building, but in Glasgow for 100 years. It was in that sense well known, and I've met people in New York who claimed that...
Was this called Brown's?
It was called Daniel Brown's Limited. Daniel Brown Limited in St. Vincent Street. But people said, yeah, we used to court there and things like that. But it was not making money. After the war, it was not making money. And it kept going for quite a while. But my father didn't persuade myself and my brother to go into it, and we didn't even think of it. There was a point when I was a graduate student, a couple of years later in London, work wasn't going well, and I said, this is a very depressing business I've got myself into, can I come back and help you? Fortunately, he dissuaded me. He had, in fact, been an engineer on the Clyde during the First World War. And
not in Brown Shipyard?
I think not. Somewhere in government, though, I believe. Mm. I know nothing about that, apart from what he told me that when he cycled from work, from home to work, from Pollitshields to whatever. Gotten. The fogs were so bad that you put the wheels of your bicycle into the tram lines and guided yourself to work that way. But I knew nothing about that side of him, really.
What sort of man was he?
He wasn't always very well. Stomach ulcer. An intelligent man. He had some very good friends. He worked well, and
did he inspire you? I mean, you say he was an intelligent man. Was he a widely read man, or?
I don't think he was widely read, but he was always interested in what I was doing at school. So we would do geometry together. He would be interested in any mathematics I was learning, and. My mother, of course, having been a teacher for a short period, knew more on the English side, and that was a good start for me on that side. But we didn't actually have a great collection of books in the house. He did give me The World of Science by Sherwood Taylor, quite a fat book, So he clearly understood my interest in that direction, and it was evident when I went to school in the Glasgow Academy and there came a new teacher of chemistry that I was quite inspired to do chemistry. I was obviously better than anyone else in the class, but I could understand in a way that none of others appeared to.
What school was it that you went to?
The Glasgow Academy, which was in the West End, of course. So I used to travel by train every day.
It was a pretty good school, I imagine.
Yeah, there were the three or four very good schools in Glasgow. Glasgow High School, Hutchison's Grammar, and a variety of schools. It was a good school. The chemistry teacher suggested to me that, or to my father, that I might sit for a scholarship in Cambridge. Now, that would imply taking another 2 years at the school, going back and starting to learn some Latin, which I started to do, and but in fact, rumours of war and then war, in effect, wrote that off altogether. The idea vanished, and it wasn't a very strong idea in my mind anyway. So I went to Glasgow University.
Just before leaving school, did you have any particular hobbies at school? A lot of scientists seem to be bird watchers or collecting fossils or interested in music or games or sport. Were you interested in any of those sorts of things?
I don't think I was. No.
You just worked hard. Are you interested in music?
I have become so. Yes. And that was rather dependent initially. Well, my mother was helpful here. And subsequently, when I got to the university, my closest friend, who I see every twice a year, that was at the ETH now, Zurich, it was in his house that I heard these big, what were they,
78 records, yes.
Yes, the Beethoven quartets. And piano sonatas, some of them anyway, and I suddenly realized there was something out there that, you know, I essentially knew nothing about, but when I finally got to London, I started to listen a good deal more.
Okay, well, let's go back to Glasgow University.
Yes.
You went up at what age, at the usual age?
Well, the usual age in Glasgow being 17, was
17.
I think it would be 17, yes. One took one's hires, and there was no entrance exam, then one went. And that was fine. But the war arrived, and the interesting system at that time, which I think looking back was quite important, was that if you were doing well, i.e. getting a first at every examination that happened along the way, you could stay. And you were always looked at by someone, a professor of chemistry who came from London. And
rather than going off to the war?
Rather than going off to the war. Well, if you didn't get a first every time, of course, you did go off to the war.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting that while I was at Glasgow Academy, for some reason I did not join the OTC.
Yes, Officers Training Corps.
With half a dozen others. I don't remember being in any sense pacifist. I think my father was, though. Well, he didn't use that term, actually. But
was he of a religious persuasion?
I have never known him going to a church at all. And my mother took me along sometimes. It was Presbyterian United something or other.
Yes.
And I actually still retained from that time a liking for a good sermon, and not, shall we say, the kind that we have in the chapel here, which only lasts for 10 minutes.
Mm.
I actually did.
You liked a solid hour.
A solid bit of, not necessarily an hour. I don't think I was too involved with that. But provided, you know, a philosophical background to what it was about. And, I found that interesting.
Are you a chapel goer now? Or?
No, I'm not. No, I'm of course, entirely...
Agnostic or atheist?
I'm entirely atheist, yes. And always have been, yes. But, of course, I...
Go to the chapel occasionally.
I go to the chapel and the school. We sang hymns before at assembly, and we did this. So one has a feeling for some of the ritual, though, ritual in Kings, the chapel, I find it goes far beyond what I like or was interested in.
You think there's too much ritual?
Yeah, and also, yes, of course.
You like the carol service, presumably, and so...
I do. I like to listen to the choir. I don't do it very often. But, and in fact, choral music isn't really the thing that I feel terribly strongly on. I started at one point going to the opera when I was in London, subsequently. But I'm much more interested in piano and quartet and good orchestral music.
Well, let's get back to Glasgow University. Were there any teachers or people you were studying with who you particularly remember as being influential at that time? Chemistry teachers or any other teachers who inspired you?
Interestingly, I would say there were not within the staff of the university chemistry department and physics at that time. Or as it was called, natural philosophy, was even less interesting. But they were good teachers, and the important thing was that one lived one's general life during the day in the lab that where you had your bench, and. The lecturers' rooms were through the lab, so that they always had to pass through it in order to get to their room, and that was the time you could talk to them, ask them about things, about their lectures, about this and that. There was no supervision beyond that, and that was not really supervision, that was up to us to ask questions. And it became clear to me when I arrived here, that the supervision system, at least in the sciences, did not really expect much reading. Whereas that is how we derived our information. I did, in fact, join the Chemical Society, which is now called the Royal Chemical Society, ChemSoc, in 1942, I think. My second year, for something like £5 a year, for which I got the entire journal monthly and one or two other things, from which I learned chemistry at the time, the subject that was being worked on by people, good papers were nevertheless understandable by students at our level. Among the organic chemists, at least. Which, of course, does not hold now at all. Papers, if you've been out of touch with that bit of the field, become almost meaningless to you. That's so right. I was very fortunate at that time, learning.
Yeah. So, sorry.
But the head of the department, a man called G.W. Koo, was a good chemist, and he had been at the Chester, had been associated with the Chester Beatty Research Institute in London, the Cancer Research Institute. And he had been involved in the chemistry of carcinogens. In fact, the carcinogens in coal tar, or soot, that kind of source, and the extraction from a ton of that, whatever it was, let's call it coal tar, of several pure crystalline compounds, which when rubbed on the back of a mouse created a tumor.
Mm.
This was the work with the man called, because shall I say that when I had finished in Glasgow, he suggested, well, there might be a job with the Chester Beatty Research Institute. I became a research student there.
Mm.
The head was a man called Ernest, or E.L. Kennaway.
K-E-N-O-W-A-Y.
Kennaway, yes.
Yes,
K-E-N-N. A great rationalist, very serious man, but I got on well with him because he retired while I was there, and I used to talk to him a great deal. So I was involved then with a man that had done the thing that started what I might call cancer chemotherapy, cancer, an understanding of carcinogenesis by finding a pure compound in nature. The one, in fact, that had been known for a century, maybe even two centuries, and discussed by a man called Percival Pott, called chimney sweeps cancer, when the small boys climbed, cleaned chimneys by climbing up them, and the tumors. So I think I had learned quite a lot, although the thesis I wrote was so dreadful, in my opinion, at the time.
Was this the one at London?
In the one at London.
Which part of London was this? Which university did you go to?
Imperial College.
Yeah.
But one didn't go there. I mean, Chester Beatty was just part of it. I worked with a man who had been...
So you stayed in Glasgow, you mean? Or did you go down to London?
Oh, no, I was in London.
Mm-hmm. You went to the Chester Beatty, yeah.
Yeah.
So your thesis, you thought, was dreadful. Was it... Who was your supervisor for that? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. It was...
What was wrong with it?
Oh, well, you start by thinking that certain kinds of things may be, have an anti-cancer effect, some things in the literature. You start following that up. You make 20, 30 compounds of that kind. And in fact, of another one, a very simple one, that somebody had noted while I was there, and I made maybe about 100 of them. But they didn't advance the subject at all, quite simply. And I looked at this thesis again a few weeks ago, just to convince myself that it really was terrible. And when I read it again, I discovered, oh yes, that the work wasn't very significant, but I had actually learned a lot.
Mm.
I mean, I knew quite a lot about carcinogenesis and this and that. In fact, effect, and I had discovered that, among other things, that that the genetic material, which was the thing that was clearly going wrong in carcinogenesis, was probably DNA. That was the view that was coming through just at that time, and not that proteins were the things that were at fault, and at least not at fault in the initial sense. And it was for that reason that I went to the man in London. The new director said, well, you could go to Cambridge for a little while. I'll explain that in a minute. What you did wonder, I think, what kind of things I was reading. And maybe I should just say that with the small group in Glasgow that I associated with, and of the four, one died this last year, but the other three, and we're in good touch with each other still. We were reading Jean-Paul Sartre at the time. I was reading Mauriac and Gide. I think we were all reading those. And another Frenchman, Duhamel, the Pasquier Chronicles, in which there was a character. It was a three generation sort of story around Paris. There was a character called Laurent, who was a young scientist. And a sister that was a musician, and so on. But the important point was, I think I really did find that French literature, which I was reading in translation, of course, had an intellectual content that I didn't meet in reading works in English, shall we say. Mm. So though I was reading a bit of Shakespeare, and in fact becoming very caught up with Shakespeare's sonnets, but that would not be unusual, I think, and thinking terribly highly of the people around 1800, I mean, you know, Keats, Shelley,
Wordsworth,
and then moving a wee bit into Tennyson, but it was less important. I did nevertheless feel that the French writers were talking a philosophical view of life, which one of them didn't derive either in Glasgow, London. Clearly we were reading other things, of course, at the time. In Glasgow we read C.P. Snow, but then one realized afterwards that all Snow was doing was putting up a set of cardboard figures. I mean, there was no depth to them at all. Mm. And furthermore, he was deriving his characters quite a bit from people he knew already. Mm. Nevertheless, the only one, shall we say, that I really felt for was the one called The Search. Mm. You may have read it. It was not part of the Masters and all that series at all. It was about his own failure as a physical chemist, I think. But he put the failure onto a crystallographer, and that crystallographer was obviously Max Perutz.
who you knew, presumably.
Oh, who I've known for years. Mm. Mm. until he died, a year or two ago. Another individual who was so clearly J.D. Burnell.
Mm. Did you know him?
I've met him, but at that time he had had a stroke, and I didn't really very well. And he was called, I think, Leo Constantine or some such name, with the mop of hair. And, but I got a feeling for Cambridge at that time. In a sense, I've moved into Cambridge now, but I got a feeling for, you know, cycling home from the lab in 7 or 8 at night in a, on a kind of damp,
thin
winter
evening,
you know, and thinking, yes, you know, snow is describing someplace or other. The kind of thing I'm feeling about this place, this, a kind of very strong feeling that I found a place that suits me very well. Well, I seem to have jumped back to...
Let's see how you got from London to Cambridge. That would be interesting, because you felt your thesis was not much good, but what did you do at the end of it? Did you go on in London, or was that when you came to Cambridge?
I did write that up. I did stay at the Chester Beatty one further year. Did very little work. I did a lot of reading. Got interested in certain aspects of nucleic acid chemistry. And let's face it, the subject was actually in confusion, and it really, really was. I can mention that a wee bit more, but when the head of the Chester Beatty said, go to Cambridge and stay a bit and learn some nucleic acid chemistry, that was a suggestion to go with a friend of his, because they knew each other in Edinburgh. The man from the Chester Beatty, and Alexander Todd, who had at one point been in Edinburgh. And Todd had made a fairly meteoric rise in the profession. Todd had worked with the great chemist of Oxford, Sir Robert Robinson. And then he had moved into an interest, and he had spent a year in Edinburgh, a year or two in Edinburgh, with a man called Barger, George Barger. And I found that George Barger had been a fellow of this college at the time. But Barger was going downhill at that time, and it would appear, at least in a biographical memoir that Todd wrote of one of the other people there, he gave the impression that he himself had kind of taken over running the place. But that was Todd's character. But he was learning to work on things that were then very difficult, because they were only present in small amounts in living tissues. In fact, the vitamins, and the things that derive from the vitamins. So he was developing a field that was very important but very difficult. It transpired that his father-in-law, who like Todd, of course, had been president of the Royal Society, Order of Merit, and Todd followed in.
What was his father-in-law's name, do you remember? Doesn't matter, but if he's a famous royal president of the Royal Society, he wasn't a Todd as well.
No. I've lost it.
Well,
I may fill in.
Yeah, okay. So you came to Cambridge with Todd, did you?
Well, Todd had come in 1944, I had turned up in 1948. Started work, offered something to do, wasn't terribly interested, did a wee bit of something.
Wait, was this in Bragg's laboratory, or where?
No, this is in chemistry. Bragg was in physics.
Was he? Oh, right.
Yeah. The way, later on, had more contact with the people in Bragg's laboratory when we got to know Francis Crick. I started working with Todd, or with Basil Lithgow, who was actually a teaching fellow here. The first year.
In King's?
Yeah, you I was here. In Christ College.
Yeah.
I was then.
You were attached? You were a fellow of Christ?
I was attached, not a fellow, I became a graduate student even. Thinking my thesis was so bad, I thought I'll do one in Cambridge. And joined the college for this purpose. Well, although I came to work with Todd, my first impressions of Cambridge, which I had never seen, never been to in all the years I was in London, I had never been here. I had no concept of the place. I arrived in Christ College with my friend Hugh Forrest, who had come from Glasgow and gone to the National Institute of Medical Research in London, so we were close friends. And we came here together. We landed in Christ College. I think maybe he got used to it more effectively than I did because he played rugby. He joined in things that were important. Christ College at that time. Now, I found it a terrible institution. I mean, I really was very taken aback. Once living in London, at least you could do what you wanted. You learned things in a different way. And you suddenly found yourself being very like, a student who might have come from a public school, right? And it was a finishing school for them. It wasn't a finishing school for me, it almost finished me off. I didn't enjoy it. Well, then just to put it quite simply, that finally didn't matter because I had joined a lab which was really on the up and up. It was going very strongly. There were people coming from over the several years from almost every country that you can think of, but lots were coming from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, some from Ghana. Then then people from Europe. Two very good Russians that were allowed to come because Todd told, who was it at the time? It was Khrushchev. That if they wanted to send somebody, they can send him, but they're not going to have someone hanging about looking after them and keeping an eye on them. They're going to be part of the lab. So we had very good contacts with two Russians. And so it was a very cosmopolitan department, and the work that Todd had done, he'd spent several years in Manchester, and had got a big school going, which was in a sense directed to vitamins and to the things that derived from vitamins, and had connections with the nucleic acids. So I turned up at an interesting time. The nucleic acids were not discussed much because the work on coenzymes and methods of phosphorylation, because that was the thing that Todd had started that brought him a Nobel Prize, to develop methods of making compounds with phosphates, phosphate esters, phosphate diphosphates, triphosphates, ATP, and so on. But he hadn't got on to nucleic acids. And my reading of nucleic acids, or shall we say RNA, which was the thing that interested me, was, and I've looked at it a lot since, the situation was just really quite chaotic. How the bits were joined together to make any kind of reasonably large structure, just not understood. And they were not understood for one reason. If, I may put a wee bit chemistry in here,
yeah.
A nucleic acid was at least thought to be a chain of things. This is before the genetic code and all the rest, but nevertheless, it was a somewhat elongated thing. And for DNA, it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger as methods were developed to measure the size of it. But RNA was less stable, and the results that other people got were not telling them very much. When you have a thing that's a chain, you expect to be able to find the linkage points, or rather the linkage points between one and a phosphate and the next nucleoside. But the curious thing was that for 15 years, I think, before I got there, everyone believed that there was just one product that you got when you broke RNA down. And it was called adenylic 3' phosphate, uridylic 3' phosphate, they were all 3' phosphate. And then amazingly, somebody in Oak Ridge, Waldo Korn.
That's K-O-R-M, is it? Or Waldo Korn, is it?
Korn,
C-O-H-N. Okay.
Found you could use the methods that were used for separating metals, I mean, uranium business in those days. You could use them for separating the nucleotides that you got from hydrolysis of RNA, and found, no, you didn't only get one, the 3' phosphate, you got two, and two of each of the four different kinds. And he sent Todd one, a pair of them. And I was the only one around the lab. I mean, this is how I got in the business. I was the only one in the lab at that time. And he said, look, do you think you could just look at these and check them out? I think they must be the 2' and the 3' phosphates. And he said, well, you know the 5' phosphates because they've been known a while and we've synthesized them. We know the 2' phosphates because a chap in the lab the year before had synthesized the 2' phosphates and claimed they were different from the other two. So there's no doubt the three different possibilities were actually known and available. Just tell me which is which of these ones, these two that Waldo has sent us. And I spent the next year proving that the work of Todd and a friend of mine in the lab at the time, Mittelson, had synthesized was not the 2' phosphate, but was the same as the 5' phosphates that were well known. Work in some other lab had done the same kind of thing. I got their stuff. Show that the 2' phosphate, in fact, had not been synthesized. The question, therefore, was, these two things must have been the 2 and the 3' phosphates, but which was which? Well, that started me in the business, and I started synthesizing them. I also started working with a so-called ester of these compounds, a benzyl ester, no less, nucleoside phosphate benzyl diester. And that looked to me, you see, just like an internucleotide linkage in RNA, or might be. So I took these 2', 3' things, the benzyl I talked to a friend of mine, a Frenchman, one evening in our digs. We talked about his work on phospholipids. And I woke up to the fact that night that the things I had represented in the same sense as the chemistry he had been discussing with me in the lipids, phospholipids, my compounds might be analogues of the internucleotide linkage in RNA. I did the experiment next day, showed that they hydrolyzed and did the right thing. I had got the idea. I knew how to find them. I explained, in fact, why there was always the phosphate was stuck at this end and it never showed up what was at this end. Well, there was a lot of work followed from 50, from about 1950 to 51, when we cleared up the whole business. And then it took a wee bit longer to 56 to make sure that what we used to call the A and the B phosphates were in fact the 2' and 3'. So we actually, over that period of 6 years, by essentially doing no work on the natural product, i.e. RNA, but taking the literature, but using synthetic intermediates that derived from Todd's work on phosphorylation, we proved the basic structure of RNA. We didn't only do that by ourselves, because we had to find some way of associating what we had done with, as it were, the reality, people were working on with RNA itself. And the people were available. In fact, there were two people, not in biochemistry, but in a department over in that neighborhood, called Markham, Roy Markham, and John Smith, J.D. Smith. They were great workers, worked hard, drank a lot of beer at lunchtime, worked hard, drank a lot of beer in the evening, and were and they published rapidly. And our work fitted exactly and explained some of the chemists, the things that they were observing. It was two-way. Now that was a great period, actually.
Yeah, sounds very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that was my, there's no doubt, that was my best period. And, of course, it was, shall we say, for that reason, that though I was always supposed to be going back to the Chester Beatty, Todd said, "Do you want a job?" Well, of course, the answer was yes. He not only, he did something that in a sense surprised other people in the lab. He didn't just say, "Okay, you can become a demonstrator now, start at the bottom." Because if you remember then, but you don't remember.
Yes, I do
but
remember.
But then, a lectureship was something you could aim at and stay at.
Yeah.
And he made me an assistant director of research, of which there were a few around the university. It meant that I could carry on work without teaching, without demonstrating and I got a huge amount of work done as a result. It was very good. It had the unfortunate effect that I didn't learn how to teach at the kind of level, the early level, and I never have been a good lecturer.
Do you enjoy your...
I don't enjoy lecturing, and I occasionally do it well and often do it very badly. So that's always been so.
What about, have you done much college supervision?
Well, when Todd gave me the job as ADR, Lithgow, who was in the department, left to go to Leeds, and I stepped in to become college lecturer.
In King's?
In King's, in chemistry.
This was about mid-50s, was it, or...?
This was 53, I think it was. Well, most of my life at the time was spent in the lab. But I did do my supervision, my 6 hours or whatever.
How did you find that? Did you quite enjoy that?
I quite enjoyed that. Met up with good types and they're good students and who've done well. And
what about PhD supervision? Have you done much of that, or supervising doctorates?
Well, yes, when I was in the lab, and over the years, I think I'm about 30 odd
really?
People I looked after all the years.
And that also you enjoyed?
Well, that was my life, after all. There's no question. The early bit that I was talking about, I was working on the bench solidly. But curiously, I came to this point having essentially got the general RNA structure right, and how it hydrolyzes, and therefore how enzymes hydrolyze it, and the general structure of DNA, which the general chemical structure, which was not the same as the structure that Francis Crick and Jim Watson were looking at. They were looking at the they weren't looking at the chemical structure. They were looking at how the long chain is organized, and came up with the double helix. No, but as soon as I had finished working that bit of RNA chemistry, the things that other people in the field were then beginning to do were, put in a more general sense, biochemistry. And they were learning to use radioactive intermediates. And I didn't want to do this. So I looked around for another subject, which was, I called a super RNA problem, which were the phosphoinositides. And for a number of years I worked on that, but also worked on the hydrolysis of esters, phosphate esters. And we derived a lot of interesting chemistry. You see, the theory of organic chemistry, up to the time I was learning it at university, was almost all just carbon chemistry, making, breaking carbon bonds, and a lot of other things related. But suddenly, people started looking at esters, carbonyl compounds, and that opened up another realm that was in the 40s, 50s, And then when Todd started on the phosphorus chemistry, that was another kind of chemistry almost. And so I, with one or two very, very fine people, one of whom was Neil Hamer, who's in Trinity, but he was my research student and he was a Kingsman, so he sometimes appears here. He was very, very bright. And we discovered quite a lot of interesting things. So I was involved with phosphate ester chemistry and phosphorylation methodology. And that took me through my next period. And my next period, while I was now a fellow and teaching here, and I could talk about what I thought about the place.
Yes, just briefly.
just briefly, yes. I mean, I found myself thrown into into a mixture. There were about 60 fellows, of whom 50-odd were in residence, I guess. Stockdale, and then, and of course, Annan had arrived a few years before. And I was told, yes, you dine three nights a week.
You were married by this time to Margaret, were you?
Well, having got a university job and become a teaching fellow, we decided that we would be able to marry. I was very careful about that. But that was the right thing to do, I think. Actually, I kept telling graduate students and research students, get your thesis before you get married. Well, so I did get to know all the people here, the ones, you know, there was Beavis, there was George Salt, Stockdale, I associated with a good deal, who looked after chemists, Edward Shire, Nicky Caldor, Lord Kahn, not Lord then maybe, but...
Were there any that you were particularly fond of or got on well with?
I got associated with, I don't know that I particularly liked him, a man called Kenneth Harrison. He was a biochemist, but he never did any biochemistry. And he finally lost his job, although the head of the department tried to help him on. He was very good on the chapel windows. He was interested in that, wrote a book on the subject.
What about Bernard or Edmund Leach?
They came a little later, you see.
Yeah.
Not very much later. And it was at that point I was getting to know people properly.
And you like Kings more than Christ.
Than Christ, yes. But I guess Christ would be changing its ways.
By then, yeah.
But it does sound to me, from what people appear to say, that though they go to other colleges, I'm talking about students, if they had their choice, they'd come here. And how they, will they get this idea, I don't know. But there is no question that this, you know, that this college is, in a real sense, different from most others. And that derives way back from the period of Shepherd, when he was a young man. Our poet,
Rupert Brooke.
And the variety of these ones. Looking into them a bit, it was clear that this was they were different, and we're not just talking about the fact that they were homosexuals or whatever. They were different in that. Very general fashion, and I think that feeling of that you could think and do things which were normally outside the normal runner of how you lived and and within your college. So it was different from Christ College, certainly in my time, because it was a very strict place. Well, this ceased to be. And of course you will know the background, of course, there's no point in me discussing the questions of bringing in women at an early stage, the work that Jim Turner did to arrange this, which was not easy. So the other women's colleges were not put out.
Mm.
And, well, these are matters I wasn't involved in, but in favour. So this was a place I became used to, but I think it's very difficult really to be in any sense sure about this, that I did as well and possibly better by learning my initial university studies in Glasgow rather than here. That we taught each other and we read in our subject, whereas in Cambridge the relationship of the university, I'm talking then about the lab for instance, and the college were orthogonal to each other and led to a situation where you finished work at 12:30 or 1, you shot over to the college for lunch and then you shot back again. Meanwhile, your other colleagues in the lab did exactly the same into their college. The students that you taught here came to supervision here, but you didn't teach people in other colleges. The college operation in the teaching sense was distinct from here, from that in other colleges, and the interaction of the students in your subject, at least, was cut apart by people heading off to their own college at lunchtime, supper time, and the like. As my work, after what I was telling you, was concerned, one very important situation occurred, i.e. the appearance in 1959, I think, of Sidney Brenner.
Mm.
Now, my chemistry had kept moving me away from the center of chemistry, as it, one might define it, in the department. And it was moving very far, very much in the direction of the kind of things that Sidney involved himself in. And so I got interested in chemistry associated with genetics. And that built up. I went back to nucleic acids again. My students went and worked in the MRC molecular biology lab. I didn't see them quite often for a long time. And slowly I moved over there so that when I came to have a sabbatical and then retire, in effect, retired a little early, I went and worked there. I had therefore two careers, one in chemistry and one in molecular biology, although no molecular biologist would call me a molecular biologist. I'm always called an organic chemist. But that fitted, that worked very well until rather recently, I mean, you know, a year ago. Though now I find I can quite happily drop all of that and become domesticated. That's that aspect of my career. Of the people that worked with me, one one I think I would like to mention, his name was Varadarajan, Srinivasan Varadarajan.
How do you spell this?
Varadarajan.
Okay. That's fine.
His father was a lawyer, a blind lawyer, in Bangalore, who was part of the, what is the word that was used, Gandhi used, peaceful resistance.
Yes.
Was part of that. His father did go to jail occasionally for this, but there was then derived from that period a group of, well, I just call them sons of the people that were associated with the peaceful resistance kind of thing. And Rajan was one of them. But there were quite a few in Cambridge at that time. And unfortunately, they are now, you know, reaching 80, 80, whatever. And that most important generation, in my opinion, is now disappearing in India. Now, I, not much of a traveler, but I've been to India several times, five times, I guess. Rajan did incredibly well, a huge amount of work, and took the view that if India was going to become, take on more commercial industrial work, then it had to do it, it had to haul itself up by its own bootstraps, because Britain, although since the end of the First World War, knew it was going to have to leave India, you know. It took it too long to do so, but it was still holding back on letting India get into a proper industrial frame of mind. And Rajan did that for the petrochemical business.